if a product cannot be spun up, set up in a trial, and a customer left behind with value in a 60-minute call, then you're going to be in this indefinite backlog of tools people may, and with good intention, want to try, but they're never going to get to.
Welcome to the DTC Podcast, a series of conversations between the investors and operators at Dell Technologies Capital and the people who are building what's next in enterprise technologies. In this exit interview, DTC Managing Director Deepak Jivankumar talks with Varun Badwar, co-founder and former CEO of Redlock, and co-founder and current CEO of Endor Labs. They cover creating new categories in cybersecurity, how to build a customer-centric company, and what happens when you join forces with a company like Palo Alto Networks. Spoiler, sometimes things break when you scale faster than you ever thought possible.
Hey, Varun, welcome to the DTC podcast series under the title Exit Interview. Hope you're having a good day. Thank you for joining us today.
Deepak, thanks for having me. It's always a fun dialogue chatting with you. So looking forward to this.
Varun needs no introduction, but I will still make the introduction. Varun is a third-time founder. He's currently the CEO of Endor Labs, and prior to this was a GM of Prisma Cloud. Came into Palo Alto through the acquisition of Redlock, where he was CEO and co-founder. And before that, he was a co-founder at Cypher Cloud. So third-time founder now. We hope we can all learn from your experiences. So let's start with the fun part of your last company, Redlock. Both of us know that there was no category called cloud security. There was nothing called CSPM in the initial days of Redlock. So how was it creating a new category then? And can you shed light on when you felt the market was catching up to you? And how did you feel that?
Deepak, it's a great question. And kind of going back, rewinding to 2015, you know, I don't think I sat there saying, like, let me go figure out a thing I'm going to do and some market where I can create a category. I think it started with a clear problem that was in front of my eyes from even my prior experience having built Cypher Cloud, where, you know, 2010 to 2015 was all the era about moving enterprise apps to SaaS. And for me, wireless building Cypher Cloud, what was becoming very evident was nobody wanted to run data centers anymore. And everybody's kind of next move was to do the new things in the cloud. When cloud at that point really meant AWS. There wasn't a lot of choices for cloud. And I think for me, it was just the way I have found myself to be most successful in building companies is to just have lots and lots of open-ended conversations to understand priorities, what's keeping security teams up at night. What is that next big blind spot? Because if you think about any industry, you know, before you get into advanced threat detection and other aspects, it all starts with a visibility problem. Like you start sensing a visibility gap as now in 2024, most CISOs are sensing that discomfort of visibility around AI and LLM use. 2015, that was cloud. And, you know, I think for me, that was the first principal argument to get into cloud security was to say, okay, there's going to be this whole next frontier of technology adoption that security teams will be completely blindsided to. And how do we go solve that problem? And I think digging into that further and further, and kind of as we'll get into this conversation, I'm sure we'll peel the layers of the onion, was what eventually became, I'm stumbling upon a problem. Wait a minute, this problem is large enough where it's going to warrant creating its own category. And obviously now, if you look at it, billions and tens of billions of dollars are being spent securing the cloud.
Yeah. No, that was a great fun ride that we had together in building Redlock. So you talked about first principles, understanding of a problem, because I think you had like a significant advantage because you were a customer of security products before. You were in the practitioner's viewpoint. How did that influence your thinking about building a product as you were the head of security of Force.com at Salesforce? Did that give you a leg up? And did it help you inform your decision-making on product features, what kind of customers to chase? It looks like that was one of your key first principles.
Yeah, look, I did have an advantage, I will admit, having worked at Salesforce.com way back in 2006, 2007, when most people couldn't spell cloud security, I was kind of immersed in cloud security. So that was an inherent advantage. I think from that vantage point, what became clear is the companies that resist cloud adoption would lose the battle, and eventually you would have to embrace, because the business pressure to adopt cloud would supersede any other restrictions around security and compliance and other pieces. And third thing was like understanding the core principles of cloud architectures, you know, multi-tenancy, other aspects of what I would call, what Mark Benioff would call real cloud, not the fake cloud, when he would make his things at Oracle, were core principles that kind of gave me an early mover advantage. And I think seeing that and seeing what happened with SaaS adoption in the early 2010s, it was just very clear that business would win this battle. People would start deploying cloud applications in AWS and other clouds eventually, much faster than most organizations anticipated. And it would fundamentally start with a visibility challenge. And I always have this saying, you can't secure what you can't see. So we didn't boil the ocean. Look, when we started RedLock in 2015, there were companies, I won't name them, that were starting in cloud security around the same time, but taking a fundamentally different approach. Like they were all about advanced threat detection. And my thesis was simple. Start with the simple problem, which is a visibility gap. And if you think about it, 10 years, almost 10 years later, 9 years later, CSPM and cloud security still starts with the number one challenge being visibility or lack thereof. So it was a foundational problem in 2015. It's still a foundation problem in 2024. Obviously, maturity has evolved. And for us with RedLock, that's what we started with, is the visibility gaps and the lack of perceived control, because now security teams didn't have the separation of the developer wants a service, so they write software, then they request a firewall rule from the network team. All of those boundaries were gone. So all of a sudden you had the developer who could spin up a workload, write the application, set the firewall rule, set the security parameters, and off you go. And there are more security problems due to all of this removal of separation and segregation of duties, where people were clicking buttons and making high impact changes that you just didn't understand.
You know, I think you said something very insightful there. Start with the simple problems. While it is easy to conceptualize, but it's harder to productize. How do you productize simplicity? Did you look for any specific KPIs or requirements on how do you productize simplicity?
Yeah, I've had this KPI and I've followed this along even at Endor Labs, which is my directive to the team is if a product cannot be spun up, set up in a trial, and a customer left behind with value in a 60-minute call, then you're going to be in this indefinite backlog of tools people may and with good intention want to try, but they're never going to get to or not going to get to fast enough. So yeah, the single biggest KPI for me is if I have an hour with a prospect, what can I showcase within an hour? In fact, at Endor Labs too, I have another philosophy, which is I personally certify every salesperson, every go-to-market person that comes in this company, is within 30 minutes, I want you to be able to give your slide deck pitch and overview and a product demo within 30 minutes and leave 10 minutes for questions. So 10-minute slides, 10-minute product demo to showcase value, 10-minute Q&A and next steps. Because frankly, security teams, whether it's a CISO or a practitioner, are way overworked and are getting hounded by 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 security startups. They don't have more than 30 minutes to make a determination of whether they're going to spend more time with you or not.
So Varun, one of the key things that you came up with at RedLock was the cloud security intelligence team. And what do you think was the contribution of that team to your success?
Yeah, Deepak, it's a great question, right? And this kind of goes into a bigger question if I zoom out, which is going back to the thousands of startups out there vying for attention for security teams. How do I make it to the top three, top four priorities of the year for you? Mm-hmm. And how do I do it with not ambulance chasing, but actually value creation, right? And for something as new as cloud, how do I make sure people understand the gravity of the situation? And so the idea behind the cloud security intelligence team was to publish research around our learnings around the emerging threats in the cloud the emerging exploits that are actually out there in the wild. People had social security numbers there, account numbers there, credit card numbers there, incredible amounts of data. One check of a button could make that entire data set public. And that what we would find is we would just like simple things. We would just like scan the internet for open interfaces in the cloud, and we would find all kinds of just crown jewels of organizations' information sitting out there. And so what we started doing is we never charged people for this service, but oftentimes we would stumble upon a large enterprise. I'm not going to name names, except maybe a couple that we made public. But, you know, we would stumble upon their information. We would report it to them as good Samaritans. We would help them understand that. But a lot of that data went into the research that we anonymized and shared with the world of where these different attacks and risks are for you. You know, one of the ones that actually was made public through responsible disclosure was, you know, we found Tesla had crypto mining going on within their cloud environment. They had no idea until we reported it. And, you know, again, that was just a great understanding of like, look, people aren't just after your data in the cloud. Like one of the most valuable things is if I can use hundreds of thousands of dollars of your compute on your dime, like that is an expense and attack vector for me as an organization I have to defend myself against. So we use the opportunity of the CSI team to not just be good Samaritans and report issues back to organizations where we would find them, but aggregate that information and use that as research and educational material to help organizations understand why they need to do something about cloud security now and not wait for a year, 2 years, 3 years to prioritize these initiatives. That education combined with the simplicity of the product and time to value really was part of the secret sauce of how we were able to, you know, get tremendous traction within a short amount of time before we got acquired.
I remember distinctly that within probably a year or so after raising Series A, where we got involved in leading the round, you were getting pinged by many potential acquirers. And that was a surprise for all of us. And of course, we all said no for a few times before eventually taking the offer from Palo Alto Networks. Why were there so many acquirers interested in you?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot to unpack here. Let me start with a disclaimer. I often talk to founders that ask me, hey, I want to get acquired in the next year. Like, how should I do it? And my answer always is, don't start a company with the premise of like, I'm building this to be acquired. You want to build a great company and you don't want to sell, you want to be bought. Okay. So that's fundamental philosophy number one. If you take the principle of I want to get acquired in 1 year, so what should I build? A, you don't control timing and a lot of other things, external factors. And B, you will probably take shortcuts that will prevent you from being a good acquisition or a good integration in the long term, because we'll get to what happens after a successful acquisition momentarily. Now, with that said, I think it goes back to the fundamentals, Deepak. Like we talked about CSI. Like with CSI, we were punching above our weight class as a brand. Like RedLock was a well-known brand 2 years since inception. People knew what RedLock was. And they knew that RedLock was a perceived early market leader in cloud security. That's one. They generally also knew that there was a high integrity team behind this company, strong engineering team, strong go-to-market team, strong partner ecosystem that was supportive of the movement, if you will. And the third was, you know, we had metrics to show. Like, we didn't need to get acquired. We had money. We had raised for Series B. We were going to continue to grow and expand because we had such amazing metrics and growth to show.
Of course, choosing an acquirer is like as complicated as choosing or courting an investor. Why did you ultimately end up choosing Palo Alto Networks and why did they choose you?
I think there's a number of things that go into this. So if you remember the dynamics, Deepak, of 2018, springtime, Palo Alto Networks was in the market to buy a cloud security product. They had looked at RedLock before deciding to move forward with Evident.io. And I think for them at the time, Evident was kind of bigger from a perspective of customers. And, you know, that's a decision they made. We respect it, right? So as far as I was concerned, when Palo Alto Networks made a phone call to us in the summer of 2018, after Nikesh had just become the CEO, for me, my first reaction was, you know, you're my biggest competitor now. Like, you know, it's just kind of a joke. And I think in the matter of the next week or so, I think they demonstrated their commitment that this was directed from the top. In fact, the first conversation I had after that was not with Corp Dev, but with really Nikesh and I sitting down one-on-one and having the conversation. And I would say, frankly, it was a meeting of the minds, right? Like, he had come from Google. He had a mindset of the best products win. He also understood how large of an opportunity, you know, the cloud security market was going to present to Palo Alto Networks to shift from a firewall and hardware company to a subscription-based revenue. And I'd say over the course of the next couple of weeks, it happened pretty quick. The third thing that was really important to align on is how were we going to make this, you know, acquisition successful. It was high stakes for Nikesh. It was his first acquisition. It was high stakes for us because we wanted to keep building. And, you know, we agreed on this model where for the first time, Palo Alto Networks created a separate business unit, product unit model, what they call speedboats. And RedLock became the first underpinnings of Prisma Cloud. And, you know, he provided us the oxygen to really continue to expand. In fact, you know, I thought it was ludicrous when we talked about the metrics to say, okay, this company with single digit million ARR going to get to 100 million ARR was the goalpost he set for us in the first 12 months after acquisition. And I'm like, how is this going to happen? But you know, we had the right oxygen, we had the right support, the right resources. We ran it as a separate business. I had a lot of autonomy to continue to scale. But fundamentally, if the product foundation wasn't there, we would never have been able to achieve those wild metrics at the time that we thought were just unachievable. But having the right DNA of the organization, the right support from Palo Alto Networks, where it was just enough involvement, not kind of stepping on the toes, on understanding and trusting us to know how to sell cloud security, which was a different motion than firewall security. And the product holding its core foundation and enabling the scale that allowed us to go from, you know, dozens of customers to hundreds and then thousands of customers in very short order. And that goes back to tying into my comment. Like, if you started with thinking about building for an acquisition, you would have taken a lot of shortcuts in the foundations of the product, in which case maybe you would have had a successful exit, but you wouldn't have created a legacy for yourself after that, because post-exit, there would have been a lot of problems uncovered in the foundations of the company and product.
Yeah, I think the best founders want not only to have a successful acquisition, but also a successful post-acquisition experience and the product to grow, as you said, the business to grow 100x instead of a bigger platform. And I think you were able to achieve this, and this probably might go down as one of the best acquisitions in cyber, as RedLock created the underpinnings of Palo Alto Prisma Cloud, which has been like an industry winner. So you mentioned some of the key things that made you successful: speedboat, executive support from Nikesh. Anything else that created the conditions of this massive success?
You know, Deepak, where most acquisitions, the reason most acquisitions fail in cybersecurity is because the acquirer wants to run the company their way. And that means, okay, you know, I acquired a 100-person company, 30 engineers go into my core 5,000-person engineering company, 10 salespeople go into my thousands of sales army company. And what happens is, they all get lost within these organizations. They lose direction. They lose momentum. And trying to take a company that hasn't sold in that market, or at least not successfully, which is probably the reason they're acquiring you, adds a lot of inertia in the process. So I would say, if you look back, not just at RedLock, but also the acquisitions we did after at Prisma Cloud for Palo Alto Networks, The philosophy remained the same. Keep these organizations as tightly coupled units. Let the founders of these companies run the show and give it space and time. before you try to make changes, right? And I think that's the most, that's like simple to say, very hard to execute in reality, navigating large organizations. But it's just that, like that was the reason for success. And of course, having a very strong product and foundation and brand to build on, where it's not just I built it, I bought a mediocre company and then I put it in a large ethos of selling with SKUs that can be sold within a platform, but truly buying best of breed products that have early proof of being market leaders, kind of evaluating the ability to scale those technologies and platforms up quickly, getting the commitment of the leadership team of the acquirer of the company being acquired to focus on certain goals and objectives that are agreed upon pre-acquisition, and then executing is what I think makes these things very successful for Palo Alto Networks.
That's great to know. So you have set the bar really high as the founder of RedLock and the GM of Prisma Cloud. How are you going to beat the bar again with being a founder for the third time? So why start another company and why are you taking on this burden?
It's a great question. I had to spend a lot of time convincing my wife why I wanted to do that. But well, listen, one, it makes me happy. I enjoy building. Second, I don't go around and say like, this is my time. Hey, in 3 months, I want to start a company. So let me go figure out what I should work on. The way all three companies have happened is, you know, I guess call it coincidence, call it luck. I've stumbled upon problems that help me see through earlier than others might some large technology shifts and the impact they're going to have on security and productivity and so on and so forth. So to answer your question here, if you remember summer of 2021, SolarWinds happened, right? That was a big shakeup of the industry to say, you know, while you're focused on network and endpoint and cloud now, there's this thing called software supply chain security, and that's going to wreak havoc if you don't pay attention to your software development process, right? Like think kind of prior to that, Deepak, security teams said, I worry about production. Where's my production data? Where's my customer data? Those are my environments I want to focus on securing. Software development was considered a non-production environment. And hey, frankly, what developers do there is what developers do. Who cares? And I think that kind of was the moment in time where we all firsthand as an industry got to realize this was going to be the next frontier of cybersecurity attacks. That's one. Second was like the technology shift, right? Like all of these security paradigms are caused by technology shifts. At the end of the day, software development is more like software assembly today. Developers write less of their own code. They bring in components. It's like building a car. You don't build every component. Your engineers, the first thing they want to do is look at every reusable component out on the internet. Okay, there's React framework for the table. There's an LLM from Hugging Face that can do this. There's this other component that's open source. I take these seven pieces. I assemble it with some first party code around it. And that becomes my kind of my tool, my application. Like that's fundamentally different than how we've traditionally written 80% of our code, but this was shifting. And the last piece around all of this is, you know, coming out of SolarWinds, and I had quit Palo Alto Networks to start Endor Labs before Log4j happened. But once Log4j happened, you know, the cat was out of the bag, Deepak, right? Like the government, the White House decided to publish the executive order on kind of software supply chain, open source security, and has continued to follow through with regulation, SBOM mandates, other things, which is basically saying the world, reality is pay attention to your software supply chain. Understand the components that go into your software assembly line. Understand what tools your developers use in your CI/CD pipelines. Get visibility. Give us confidence that you can attest to the software you ship and that you understand any potential risks and you have ways to mitigate it. Okay, easier said than done. Now you need to build a technology around all of that. And really, that's where we fit in. And fundamentally, we think AppSec is going to have the same moment it has that cloud security has for the last several years. If you look at most analyst reports now, AppSec is growing nearly as fast as cloud security. And traditionally, it's lagged. And we think AppSec is going to be all about not putting gates in the developer workflow, but rather empowering developers to build secure software from the onset. And that's where if software supply chain security done right will enhance and boost the productivity of developers. Not done right, it will add more tax to developers. And we think most of the tools in the market right now, quote unquote, the leading tools in the space, whether software composition or whatever else categories, they add tremendous tax to developers. They cause distrust between engineers and security professionals. And we think it's time that the next generation of tooling comes in that actually improves your software supply chain while encouraging developers to use more open source, encouraging developers to use more productivity tools in their pipeline, but do it with confidence and guardrails so you don't make the same mistakes you did with cloud 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm both afraid and hopeful for the future. I'm afraid because of the increasing threat surface and attack surface with software supply chain, but I'm very hopeful because you are there to solve the issues. Are there any other new first principles you've added to your list of first principles that you're following now with Endor Labs and company building or understanding the market or going to customers?
Yeah, you know, funny enough, Deepak, for a large part, RedLock was creating a new category. Endor Labs is disrupting an existing category. But I think those first principles remain unchanged. The couple that we haven't talked about that I want to make sure we get to is there is no product, there is no customer if you don't invest in the right team and culture. So, you know, behind all of this, it all starts with a dream. It all starts with some fuzzy vision. And the people that bring it to reality is your initial team. And I can't kind of emphasize enough just how important it is to bring the right diverse mindset. Like, I'll give you a piece we did here. You know, the very easy answer to build engineering, the first 20 engineers would have been to say, okay, hey, X RedLock engineers, Palo Alto, Prisma Cloud, 20 of you, let's go. We're starting this company. The problem, Deepak, would have been, look, it's a different domain, right? This is like Endor Labs is all around software development, software productivity, engineering productivity. The easy thing would have been call people that are all great people who worked with me in the past. The harder thing would be to say, you know what? We're going to make sure and make a commitment to ourselves as founders that no more than 2 people would be from the same company in the first 20 hires. So we actually made that pact and we went, worked our asses off to go hire 20 people from at least 10 different companies. We ended up with people from Meta, from GitHub, from Uber, Cisco, Splunk, Palo Alto, Prisma. And it was a diverse set of skills, diverse set of experiences, and it helped influence our product. Like, that's on the R&D hiring. You know, similarly, I'm a believer in giving chances to folks that are chomping at the bits for that opportunity, have proven themselves to be scrappy, to be hungry, to have grit, disrupt markets, but maybe they haven't had that choice and opportunity yet to be a VP of worldwide sales or VP of marketing. First, bet on the people around you, empower them, enable them to be successful, give them the space, give them the coaching, the mentorship. And, you know, this is what's worked really well for me in RedLock and continues to at Endor Labs. So, you know, I'm big on giving chances to the people that have the right attitude and aptitude.
Yeah, you know, that is the holy grail of hiring. Find the rising stars. And it's the future is made by rising stars. And any patterns you've seen so far in spotting rising stars, you have been really good at it.
Specifically to answer your question, like, what do I look for? You know, it's energy, it's passion, it's relevance to the space that we're in. It's, you know, obviously, what have you done? But really, more like, do you internalize your strengths, your weaknesses? Are you humble? Are you willing to learn? Are you willing to say, oh, I don't know this, but I'm willing to put in effort to learn? It's a lot about those soft elements. And I spend a ton of time, especially on critical hires, on back channel. Because while it's nice that you're giving me your prefer references. I feel like there's a lot more value I get out of conversations and people I may reach out to confidentially at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talked about the key conditions of success. So finding those rising stars, I'll add that to the key conditions of success. And of course, in addition to that, you need to find the right design customers and the right investors to help you. So any takeaways, learnings for first-time founders, but more importantly, any takeaways for second-time founders in choosing the right design partners and the right investors?
Yeah, so let's maybe talk through those two things, compartmentalize. I'm a huge believer in optimizing for the human, the investor, not the firm and the brand of the investment firm. Look, it could be a long slog. It could be a quick exit. Who knows? At the end of the day, you're looking for a partner who is willing to go through the journey with you. And the question is, not only do I want this person in the boardroom and their money, but like, would I actually enjoy hanging out with them after? Would I call them when I actually have bad news and I need help, right? Like, I always look at like my level of comfort in the human and working with the human beyond the brand. Because yes, like certain brands will give you great recruiting assistance and they'll give you amazing, you know, network of customers. But that might help you at a point in time, but that's not forever. The person you're working with is forever on your side. So a huge believer in like, gauge the individual, not the firm and the brand, and optimize for that. As it relates to design partners, I think, look, before even design partners, I have a philosophical belief of build in the open. Like a lot of people ask me, hey, when should I go out of stealth? And my answer is usually yesterday. Like building in a cave means the likelihood of you getting it grossly wrong, launching something and being like, oops, I just wasted 18 months is a lot higher than building in the open. Because my belief, Deepak, is if somebody can just hear you in a 30-minute call, take your idea, build something better than you, then shame on you and good for them. Because building a company is not just idea. Idea is a dime a dozen. It's execution. It's team. It's the whole package. And so I rather build in the open despite the risk of, oh, somebody's going to copy my idea, because I have to have confidence that I can execute or out-execute everybody else. And in building in the open, you're able to iterate on your messaging much earlier. You're able to learn things much earlier in the process, get candid feedback much earlier in the process. When you're looking at design partners and design customers, cast a wide net. Don't fall into the trap of, well, I talked to 7 Bay Area technology companies. I know what I'm doing, because the world in Central America, the world in the East Coast, vastly different, right? The technology stack, the processes for acquisition of technology, the people, the skill sets, vastly different. If you're going to build a big company, you better understand the breadth of verticals and customers and maturity of customers that you can target.
Well, this is very, very insightful. And I think a lot of Bay Area startups do fall into the trap of just building for Bay Area customers. So I'm going to ask you a very mandatory generative AI question. Has generative AI changed anything about how we are building startup this time compared to the last time in terms of recruiting, in terms of finding customers, in terms of engineering, product building?
The foundational learnings we've discussed remain unchanged. Build a solid brand, educate the market, right? With data, with research, hire the best talent, what kind of caliber to look for. I think those things don't change because of AI. That said, I think it would be fool's errand to not think about how every function in your company can become more productive or will get impacted long-term with AI. So I'll give you examples. Okay, I've told my team, like one of the directives is make sure all of our documentation is not a documentation where you search with keywords, but let's go feed that into an LLM so customers can ask like their business questions and we can feed them very targeted responses on how to use the product. Or when somebody's deploying your product, if they're running into errors, don't give abstract error codes, translate it in simple English terms what the problem is. Again, generative AI is great at that. Customer support, customer engagement, AI is great at that. you know, do we think AI is at a point where we can replace our engineers with that? No, I think that the simple way we have concluded is, you know, co-pilots of the world are amazing interns, but they're not principal engineers. So where you have certain work that's mundane, I think it can help offset a lot of that, but also don't imagine it to kind of go replace your engineers in the company anytime soon. And the last piece of all of this is, look, we're in the crux of building capabilities in software supply chain security. I talked about how software supply chain landscape has evolved. We're doing software assembly. Well, guess what? You know, if today 80% of your code is open source, in the next 2 years, it's going to be 95, 98% open source, because even the code that's generated by the co-pilots of the world is trained on open source data, right? Is it trained on publicly available code? So just embrace what your software supply chain is going to look like. It's going to be a lot more convoluted. And for us, we're constantly building products and capabilities to help simplify the software supply chain landscape. A lot of it will be influenced by AI, and there's going to be new avenues for AI-generated code, models, other things that you embed into your applications that will need discoverability and security and compliance.
Completely agree with you. We got to embrace any change before the change overwhelms us. So Varun, you have been very gracious with your time. So I want to really thank you for your time. So it has been great partnering with you in RedLock. And I'm sure it'll be even greater partnering with you with Endor Labs. So thank you for partnering with Dell Technologies Capital in both of these startups.
Thanks, Deepak. And I just want to give a shout out to you as an individual, but also Dell Technologies Capital. You've been tremendous partners to us and friends to me personally. And looking forward to a lot more success. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Varun.
Thanks for listening to the DTC podcast. If you like what you heard, you know what to do. Like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.